It's time for Lunch Hour Reviews.
You are licking me.
What?
He was licking me!
Lunch Hour Reviews.
Man, I ate until he burst.
You eating Jameson!
Speeding time. I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Ramps Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network.
For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Ramps Macabre,
please visit Fangoria.com.
This is the autopsy of an unidentified female, henceforth known as Jane Doe. This autopsy will be conducted in four stages. Beginning with an external evaluation, followed by an internal evaluation, the heart and lungs.
One thing's for sure, you're not going anywhere.
Hey, Dad, I think we should get out of here.
Everybody has a secret.
On today's episode, we are talking about The Autopsy of Jane Doe, coming out December 21st in select theaters and VOD?
Not yet. I think first it's going to hit theaters, as it well should be.
It should be. It's just like, if I was like a person and I hate going to theaters like I do, I'd be like, when can I see this movie? Lucky for us, we get screeners. But sadly for me, I didn't get to do this awesome interview that we have at the end of the episode.
I got lucky in the opportunity to interview Andre Overdahl and Emil Hirsch, the director and actor star of The Autopsy of Jane Doe. And yeah, that was great. It's always going to be challenging talking about a movie like this without giving away spoilers.
Right.
And I think the reason the movie works as well as it does is because it does sort of stay in the pocket for a large portion of the movie until things get rocking and rolling.
This is a great movie featuring two actors pretty much in a room talking to each other.
A lot of the time, yeah.
You know, and it's like so in-depth and so much gets covered in this small amount of time.
Yeah, so you got the screener. The way timing worked out, there was a premiere at Lincoln Center Cinemas with a Q&A with Brian Cox, Emil Hirsch, and Andre Overdahl. And so I got to see it with the crowd, and that was fun.
Right.
I spent a lot of time trying to, like, I was among a couple New York Horror Movie Group friends, and I didn't want to, like, make a scene. So I'm, like, biting my knuckles at times, like, just trying to keep it down.
Screener is my jam. I love getting screeners because I can turn off all the lights in my house. It's all quiet, and jump scares obviously scare the shit out of me. So there's a couple in this movie, but this was a great experience to watch this. I think it could be in the theater excellent or just at home.
Yeah. Okay, so listeners might know Andre Overdahl from his earlier movie, 2010's Troll Hunter,
which we covered in depth in hashtag Scandal Horror.
Yeah. And I think it might have gotten some mention in our found footage episode just because it sort of really challenged the typical nature of found footage movies. But in that case, it's shot like a documentary that stumbles upon this greater plot of their trolls in Norway.
Right.
This time around, it's his first English language movie, and it was pretty much set up in the studio and offered to him, and it was a good enough, enticing enough project that he jumped in.
Mm-hmm. This movie revolves around its two main characters. Brian Cox is a father figure here to Emil Hirsch. And Emil Hirsch and his father work at this morgue / crematorium.
It's the family business. They are the Tildens.
Yeah, they are Tilden and Son.
Tilden and Son.
What's great about this, Brian Cox doing his like greatest American accent, because I didn't even know he was Scottish. It just didn't occur to me.
You just found out, yeah.
Yeah, like I literally, when I was looking, I was like, what else? You know, because I'm like, Brian Cox, like he gets around and mostly I see him in American film. So I think of him as an American guy.
Yeah. I'm surprised he hasn't ever gone into Game of Thrones territory.
Yeah,
Because he could. And this cast apparently did feature an actor from Game of Thrones. He plays the sheriff.
And Emil Hirsch is the son, who I love to see Emil Hirsch. And you know how I only pretty much watch horror films, but I know Emil Hirsch from The Girl Next Door. So when I think of him, that's the movie I think of. And I think that movie's adorable.
Well, we talked about it that he hasn't done that much in the way of like horror suspense.
Right.
In the past, you know, I've recently saw him. He was in Lone Survivor. He was very good. You know, he was in Speed Racer, which frankly is an underrated movie. So the setting, we already mentioned that a lot of the movie is the two of them in a room doing an autopsy.
Right.
And the thing is, they weren't alone. Olwyn Kelly is the actress who is in 80% of those scenes. It's actually her.
And she was just such an amazing sport about doing all, you know, just being there for hours and hours, for weeks on end. And when it comes to shooting, it was very important to, in a way, treat her like kind of like an object in the beginning and then slowly let you in emotionally on her journey, on her story, as they figure her out and start to understand and theorize about who she is and what could have happened to her. You had to sympathize with her and sympathize with her, and then at a certain point you had to start fearing her. And that whole process had to be done in a way we shot her and, of course, in the way they behaved around her. And it had a lot to do with the lighting, and I was very rigid about shooting her from a frontal perspective, like you shoot actors mostly anyway, so that you constantly have a contact with her on screen that would be normal in a way, even though she's lying there. And just her head positions would create a lot of different, with some head positions she has, she looks powerful. While in other head positions, she looks very vulnerable. And we had to use those through the movie to make sure that you kind of get across a feeling of what state I want you as a director, I want you to feel for or fear her or whatever it is.
I think, of course, it's the first time I saw it tonight, and I thought that was what was such a huge success, is just the subtle variations, in particular, as you say, the way you used her head. And it was when we started, it was quite intimidating because she's a very beautiful girl, you know, and this beautiful girl comes in and lies down, and you're slightly disconcerted to start with. And then after a while, she did become an object. And we would suddenly realize that...
She was completely... she was super serious. I mean, she wouldn't talk to either of us. She just was totally, totally focused on her role. And I think there was a part of her that really wanted to kind of, not have that connection between us. You know, I think she purposefully wanted to have that kind of performance and create that kind of barrier. And it really did work. I mean, after a while, we were, I was actually always really paranoid to make sure that if it was her and when the dummy was there. You know what I mean? Because the last thing you want to do is, like, pick up some tool and it's, like, a person there, you know?
Ultimately, it does become the sort of, I mean, it's funny to think of it as an ensemble cast, but it is the three of them sort of working around each other. And their dynamic I loved. Brian Cox and Emil Hirsch are father and son, but they're also coworkers who like each other.
Right, and it's also a teacher dynamic.
Yeah. Brian Cox is like the proper mortician, you know, I guess just shy of pathologist.
Uh-huh.
And Emil Hirsch is he's a technician. He's still learning. And so you do get this, like, I love that Brian Cox is the elder statesman.
Right.
Emil Hirsch, like, I totally get the impulse. I am a true crime fan. The moment you present me with any details...
Oh, I think I know it all.
I start shaping the narrative, yeah.
Right, and I'll get the psychology.
The whodunit.
Yeah.
And Emil Hirsch goes right into that. And, you know, his dad is there to tell him, it's not our job. Our job is to focus and figure out what killed him.
Exactly. Which, yeah, that would be hard for me because I would want to shape this huge narrative. And then also, but I would be scared of every like little noise that happened down there too.
Yeah.
Because I would assume that these bodies would come back to life. That's just my assumption if I was in a morgue.
The set is so nicely designed that it does have this lived-in quality. Mm-hmm. I mentioned it is their home. Upstairs is a typical residence.
Right.
It's the downstairs, like, corridor basement where the business gets done.
But it's set up like an office with wood paneling. It's beautiful and warm. Yeah. You know, it's not like you expect a morgue to be very cold.
Yeah, or in these days, like, television has trained us that, like, it might as well be a fucking spaceship. Like, right. If it's a Hannibal-style CSI morgue room where any sort of investigation is being done, it's like a clean room where they're, like, without static building electronics. Like, but
there's a cat that runs in and out of this room. You know what I'm saying? The only – that is one of the things, though, like, maybe I think of it wrong. It's one of the only things that I would say is kind of like, I don't know about this film. I'm not sure that the procedures are so lax as they are in this film.
So during their Q&A at Lincoln Center, they mentioned that their on-hand like reference person, their sort of like professional mortician who is informing their procedures and what they're doing and how they're doing it. He talked about the casualness.
We also had a actual morgue worker named Stuart.
Oh yeah.
Who was on set, who was a very complicated guy.
He was crazy.
A great guy. And his Stuart's stories would really just whenever we would kind of have a good time or something, we would kind of go to talk to Stuart, because of course he would tell us just the most awful things you've ever heard in your whole life. You know, we'd say, Stuart, you know, tell us, what about this thing? And Stuart would be like, oh, well, there was a man who was clipping his hedges, and he clipped a barbed wire, and the barb pierced him in his neck, and he died. And I'm like, Stuart, do you ever go out on the weekend? He goes, no, I don't do anything. I'm like, do you do stuff? He's like, I don't do anything.
It was really odd. The other thing about it was that we thought, well, we should wear masks. You know, we said, well, don't we, man? Oh no, I never wear a mask.
Yeah.
Oh no, I never wear a mask. He said, I sometimes usually never wear gloves. he was the most. I mean, if you know, you're expecting it by the book. You're expecting the guy who's the expert is going to do it by the book, but not at all. He sort of threw the book away. He was a winger, but what a winger.
Yeah, but I think, like, if you were in this, like, you know, it could have who murdered, who done it kind of thing, and you're supposed to examine the body, you shouldn't want your hair, like, all over it.
I agree with you. And in that way, like, I'm definitely, if I was going to do an autopsy, it would be like Dana Scully style, like glasses, hair, hair,
you're
net.
You're not getting me on this murder.
The movie does strike this great balance of suspense, and the nature of it is body horror.
Yeah.
They are, you know, not pulling any punches with the visuals. And
no,
for that,
autopsies are gross.
The practical effects are awesome.
Sound design was great.
Yeah.
The sound design is awesome on this autopsy. It's just, autopsies are really disgusting. It's a really disgusting.
Yeah. And we get some crime scene images as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It can get pretty intense. So, like, not for the faint of heart. That said, like, it doesn't exploit the body horror. If anything, it sort of gives us the characters as the lens with which we're looking at, you know, what are sometimes these nightmarish images.
Right.
And so for that, like, it feels very disciplined. It feels very professional that, you know, it's not, I don't know, we talked about a couple movies, like, on the way to this, where typically an autopsy scene in a horror movie is going for the shock value.
Right,
is going
right.
And this has that, but that's not the point of it.
Right, exactly.
It's all an investigation.
This was one of those films that, you know, sometimes we get these screeners and sometimes for the first half of the film, I go, why did I get this screener? This is a film who knew what it was as you go through this film.
Yeah. The discovery element is probably my favorite. I mean, I absolutely adored the character dynamics between Brian Cox and Emile Hirsch, but I did really enjoy the, like, when they're finding something. It's almost like you ever do the thing where you're watching your television, but you still find yourself, like, leaning in a direction trying to get a better look.
Because I look in the corners. That's all I spend my movies doing. And sometimes I miss what's going on right in the front. Because I'm, like, trying to be like, oh, that coat over there looks like a demon or some shit.
On that note, I did pick up that there aren't standard horror movie tropes in this movie. And for that, it keeps you on your toes. Mm-hmm. There's not, you know, there aren't horror movie cliches in here. If anything, there are a couple haunting visuals that'll stay with you.
Yeah.
But as far as what he was going for, like, this is its own story. This was not an homage. There were not a lot of references to outside mm-hmm. horror. And I think that really helps the immersion of watching the movie.
Right. It's hard to talk about it, yeah, without giving anything away.
Yeah.
Because it is a father and son duo with this third character. And it never really – there like you're saying, there are horrific elements that are happening at the same time. But your focus is always back on the father and son.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're always kind of looking to them for, like, how should I be reacting to that? Like,
right.
Like it's gross to me, the layman, but yeah. I wonder how it comes off to them.
And right, because Brian Cox is, like, cool the whole time.
Yeah.
Pretty much the whole time, he's pretty cool. Even when crazy things are happening, he's like, eh. And Emil Hirsch, like, one squeaky door at the beginning, and Emil Hirsch is like, ah, ghosts. You're like, you work here, dude. Calm down.
I've seen something like this before.
So next you're going to hear the interview that I didn't get to be a part of because no. I was busy teaching the future of America how to sing.
I can insert you in the interview. I'm pretty handy with audio. I don't know if you've heard, but I'm a computer.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Just take some of my laughing, make it think that I think everything they're saying is hilarious. And go, right, yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, no, hopefully next time Mindy can sit in. It changes the dynamic. I think it also probably makes the subjects feel more comfortable, that it's a little more
that
casual.
That I'm not there?
No, when you are there.
He's like, Mindy, you're freaking him out. But I'm really cool in interviews. Like, when I met Joe Swanberg, I didn't freak out. I was really cool.
That's what I'm saying.
Inside, though, I was like, yee.
Okay, so here is the interview with Emil Hirsch and Andre Overdahl. So I was at the Lincoln Center show. That I loved it. I really had a good time at the movie. I thought it was really good. So Andre, I was gonna start off by asking you, as this is your first English language film, what was the inception? How did the project come together?
I mean, the movie was already kind of together by the time I got on board. It was already financed. It already had everything in place. Mm-hmm. They were looking for a director. They were interviewing directors. And okay. I received the script from my agents. And I fell in love with it instantly. And I was just happy that the producers were bold enough to take a chance on a director who had only done one handheld crazy kind of movie. And because my take on this movie was the opposite of Trollhunter. And it was all about being in control of the camera and being, you know, very stylistic and being, you know, just a whole different approach. So it was really down to the producers to take that chance. And I was, yeah, just lucky to be chosen.
Cool. Were you cast before Andre came on?
No. I read the script and I hit up Eric Cohn, who works at IndieWire, and I love the script, and I said, Eric, you know, this guy Andre Overdahl, and he goes, oh man, Trollhunter, you got to see Trollhunter, it's fantastic. So I watched it and I loved it, and it was really a fortunate kind of meeting of events, because it wasn't necessarily a genre that I had done before or that would really be associated with something that I would do before this time. But with a director like Andre, that he was really the X factor in that equation, because there's a lot of good horror scripts that I still wouldn't do because I just wouldn't know about the director, or they wouldn't bring something to the table that would separate it in a way that where I would want to do it as an actor. And Andre had that X factor to his filmmaking, which is just, there was that little, just something special that he brought to it. And, you know, you can see it in the film, you can see it in the reviews of the film already, and all the awards it's won at all these different film festivals. I'm so proud of you, dude. And, you know, even we just put the trailer out online the other day, and it's got like 10 million views and like 170,000 shares in just like a few days. And that's not the kind of thing that you can buy. That's not the kind of thing that you can you can't buy that kind of that kind of sharing online. You know, that's truly a viral thing.
Yeah, it was. I guess it was the talk after the Fantastic Fest screening that I first caught wind of the movie, and you know, in the horror community, you can't like help but hear details about the story. And so when the trailer came out, I stopped myself. Like I love to death trailers, but this was a movie. Like Your Name Attached was all I needed to know. That the guy who made Troll Hunter behind this is all I needed to know. The rest could be a surprise. Like all the same faith. Emil, I was going to ask you, so your relationship with Brian Cox in the movie is, you know, is one of my favorite elements, and I'm sure it's going to get talked about a ton. And you two is not just like father and son, but like coworkers who actually like each other. I was going to ask about your dynamic coming. Did you get rehearsal time to sort of figure each other out?
We had a little bit of rehearsal time where we were kind of chatting with each other and getting to know each other. I mean, we spent a lot of time together on the shoot. And that's something that, I mean, you can't really rehearse the amount of time that we spend together in terms of just rapport. And going through all these medical examiner guys giving us advice on how to conduct an autopsy. And we were both really sticklers for detail and excited to be very convincing at our jobs. We both kind of hinged the effectiveness of our performances not really getting along as father and son, but as being believable as these medical examiners, with having the faith that our performances as father and son would take care of themselves just because we were spending so much time with each other and because we actually really liked each other. But we wanted to really be believable as medical examiners. And I think one of the things that I'm the most proud of in terms of my performance and Brian's performance is that I never once go, those guys aren't real medical examiners. They don't seem like they're actually doing what they're doing for real. Because in the little details and the tiny little things that stick out like a sore thumb when you don't get them right, we put the time in and we did that right.
Last night you mentioned the technical consultant. Was it Stuart?
Stuart, yeah.
Stuart. Was the cat named after him?
That was Stanley.
Oh, Stanley. Okay.
That was named after Stanley Tucci.
So, Andre, I was going to ask you. So I'm a big fan of Troll Hunter, I've mentioned. And I watched the trailer for The Tunnel. And so with your background using CGI to really great effect in post, I'm curious if you could speak to coming from like the difference of like practical effects and this one. The physical effects are like literally immersive. If you could talk about that approach.
Yeah, I mean, it was a, how do I talk about it? It was quite scary in a way to deal with practical effects like this, but we had just the most amazing people who knew the body and the biology so well, and they had all these amazing body parts, and it was like, it looked so real, and they were so confident in everything. So I was, you know, I was relaxed about it when we were shooting. And it's amazing to me when you see all this stuff on set. It's like, it looks good. You put the camera on it and it looks amazing. It looks real. It's just the difference between, it was just so surprising to see how much better it actually looked through the camera. But yeah, no, it was, on Troll Hunter we had all digital effects. Here we had a combination. And I also had an amazing VFX supervisor, Stephen Corin, who was so good at combining real physical effects with digital effects.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear you mentioned last night that Olwyn Kelly was there for about 80% of the scenes, and while she's playing a corpse that doesn't move, I was really impressed that like that's a commitment that like she makes it an ensemble movie. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about, you mentioned that she's even enhanced by the effects in post sometimes, where you're sort of applying the effect on top of her already in the scene.
Yeah. There is, well, all the other way around. We're applying her on top of the doll sometimes.
Oh, okay.
Mostly. No, there are like 400 shots in the film that have been tinkered with digitally. Okay. A lot of it is simply her eyes, because her eyes are really brown. So we had to make them gray. Yeah. And then there is every shot she is in, we had to stop her from breathing. Because even though she was amazing at shallow breathing, yeah. we still had to make sure that she's dead.
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of the, especially horror nerds sort of pick up on even the most, the smallest minutia of like, oh, that corpse blinked or, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
But there wasn't a moment of that. There was such an authenticity.
The nerds are going to be disappointed.
Yeah, no, we went through, on a huge screen, we were sitting going through every shot, every second, slowly looking at every little muscle twitch that could possibly happen. And sometimes we were discovering stuff late in the process where, holy shit, there is a muscle twitch over right there. And we didn't see it until, we were fixing it. And even after the movie was almost done, we were still finding out that stuff.
So speaking to the authenticity, one of the things I picked up on is, I'm a pretty big horror nerd, but I didn't really pick up any specific nods to other horror movies. Like, there were no tropes, and that kept me on my toes. I was curious if you could speak to, your relationship with horror coming into the movie.
I mean, I love horror films, too. I mean, when I was a kid, I loved all kinds of horror movies, even bad ones. But today, I want to watch good horror movies.
Right.
And no, I love them, but I'm very specific about not putting in that kind of stuff personally. I want the film to stand on its own legs entirely. I don't really like the, too many nods to other movies because I don't find it to be any reason for it.
Right. It's oftentimes an unnecessary wink to the audience.
I really want the authenticity of this specific movie to be,
Emil, you mentioned that. I mean, up to this point, you've done a lot of action and adventure, and Into the Wild is a straight drama. I'm curious, do you have horror favorites? Was there a relationship before this?
To horror, yeah. I mean, I'd watched horror for a really long time. I mean, I'd seen a lot of John Carpenter and Stephen King movies, and I really enjoyed the genre. And I probably watched, a few horror movies when I was just a kid that traumatized me for a while and at the same time kind of got me used to really good horror. So, movies like The Shining and I remember I saw the miniseries of The Langoliers as a kid and I thought that was really freaky. And The Stand is a miniseries, the Rob Lowe miniseries. I thought that was great. And Silver Bullet as a kid. I think my mom's friend's son was the demented 12-year-old who showed me as a kid and just gave me nightmares forever. It was the werewolf was crazy.
So to talk about the setting, I really love the morgue crematorium setting and that it's also their home. It does have this lived-in feeling. I was surprised. You mentioned you guys filmed in London, and it's all a created set, the interior setting. That's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, it would have been impossible to find a location that would have satisfied all the needs of the production and the needs of the storytelling and also having to shoot in a chronological order, which we did, kind of prohibited us from shooting in different... I mean, we could have found one room there and one room in another location and put it... But it would have been a mess. So, and I didn't want to do it. And fortunately, the producers were able to find the resources to put this together in the way we needed to, even on our relatively low budget. No, it was...
Not relatively, just low budget.
Emil, did shooting sequentially, I would imagine that's useful as an actor in terms of the build?
Yeah, I mean, I found it really helpful, especially because it was such a confined space and it was mostly Brian and I. We really wanted to pay attention to the levels that we were at in terms of fear and hysteria, and we wanted to kind of carefully calibrate that so it was stayed interesting and never got repetitive. That's what we did. We didn't ever want our scenes to feel repetitive when we were together. We wanted to keep kind of peeling the layers of the onion back and make everyone in the audience's eyes water.
Yeah, yeah. In particular, the elevator scene is so good in that it was one of my favorite moments, and that it was the sort of culmination of this relationship, and it was this sort of, you know, it's okay to move on from here kind of moment. And it was also a closed, a very confined space. Was that difficult to film leading up to?
I mean, physically it was difficult to film a scene like in the elevator, but we had, you know, it was a set, so we constructed it so we could take out every single wall. But still, there aren't that many angles you can kind of find in that little space. But we had, you know, when you have amazing actors to shoot, it kind of...
Shot that elevator scene really quick.
Yeah, we did. It was so simple, and we had like 3-4 angles. And
it worked so well, yeah.
Sometimes, you know, those kind of long talky scenes that are sort of static where characters are sitting, I actually find some of the first takes are the best, and you can really shoot scenes like that quickly. Sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you guys were so amazing. I mean, you guys were amazing throughout the entire production, but especially in a way in that scene, because it was so intimate and low-key. And,
I also like what the composer did with that scene, too, kind of like underlying certain beats with the music, and the kind of music sort of mirrors what they're thinking or feeling. It was kind of interesting.
I was going to ask you about the music. The musicians were... They were there last night for the screening, Danny Bensi and Sonder Jurians, who they had done The Gift together, and I love that movie. I was wondering, as a last question, if you could talk about the music. Was there something you were aiming for in terms of giving them direction?
Yeah, I mean, we were trying to find something that was simple and emotional, but still modern, so it didn't use just the regular instrumentations. It needed something unique. And that's why, in a way, producers and myself gravitated towards the Danny and Sonder. It was just they had that kind of balance where we wanted to create. But it was a bit of a struggle to figure out exactly the tone of this film. We struggled for like a month, just back and forth on trying to find out what is the music of this, what is the audio world of this film. But then suddenly they cracked it. We went to the final reel, basically, the last act, and we started from there. Okay, let's score the finale of the movie first now.
Oh, that's cool.
And then we found the tone of it, in a way, or obviously they did. And then we went back, and they scored the whole movie up to there. And then suddenly it all worked out. It was like every cue they delivered was just amazing. And I remember there was one cue for the climactic scene in the middle of the movie before the lights go out, which they absolutely floored me with. This music, there was a lot of other sounds that needed to go in there, and I was like sitting in listening to the music. I don't want to put anything but this music in, but we had to.
I look forward to the soundtrack being available. I really enjoyed it. I got the cue, so that was our final question. Thank you guys for sitting down with
thank
me
you very
thank
much.
You
And we're back. We're back to say goodbye.
Yes.
We're on all the typical outlets. We're on all the social media. It's pretty easy to find us. We'll have some show links in here. Do remember, it comes out on December 21st. This is one worth watching in the theater. The build, I think it's going to be fun to watch with the crowd.
As well as all the social media, we are on Patreon, patreon.com/rantsmacabre. We also have a website, therantsmacabre.com, where we have our episode available and liner notes for everything. You can find us on Stitcher and on iTunes. If you find us on iTunes, go ahead and leave us a review, some stars, anything like that is awesome. We live for stars. I eat them for breakfast.
This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
You've been listening to The Rants Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network.
Produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment.
For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rants Macabre,
contact Ken at fangoria.com.